Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Is okay? Yep. All right. Nice to see you all here. Thanks for coming along. Let's get started. Okay, so here's our title, which you've seen before. Construction of detailed correlation structures across GI business segments. You could possibly guess why we're interested in doing that. We're trying to solve what we see as a real problem. In case you can't foresee the reasons, I'll go through them in just a second. An acknowledgement to our sponsors. This work was sponsored by the Institute, and it's also received support from a federal research grant, a three-year grant on which we've been working for a little while. Some details of that given there. Okay, so first, just an outline of the ground that we'd like to cover. As I mentioned a moment ago, the motivation, why do we want to talk about this? Then we want to talk about things called common shock models, and then an application of those to multiple claim triangles. And then after we've gone through that and built up some kind of structure, we want to try to reduce it to simple concepts that can be relatively easily applied in practice. I guess this isn't an easy field and we don't expect life to be easy, but we want to reduce it to the easiest possible terms. A short numerical example just to indicate how one might go about this and demonstrate that it produces some sensible results. Then a brief word about capital margins, and then some concluding remarks. Okay, so first the motivation, and this, whenever I, especially when I listen to a talk, also when I give one, but when I listen to a talk, I like to use this test. It's the why should we care test. Why should you, the audience, be bother to listen to what we have to say here? And if we can't give you some good reasons why you should be listening, then we should probably be thinking about whether the whole exercise is worthwhile. So who cares about large correlation matrices? Well, immediately we come to risk margins, and risk margins are total liabilities taken at moderate percentiles. So 75% I call moderate. 99 is definitely not moderate. In between, who knows? If you pick something like 90, is it moderate or not? But as far as risk margins are concerned, they're definitely at moderate percentile levels. Capital margins are definitely at high percentiles. So they're a somewhat different subject, and I'll come back to them just at the very end. But both deal with total liabilities and both require consideration of the dependencies between different business segments. Now, I'll use that phrase business segments rather than lines of business. You could choose your business segments to be lines of business if you wished, but very often business segments are somewhat smaller than that. For example, you might have a motor line of business, but it might be divided into intermediated and electronic and mail renewals. So I prefer to use the term business segment as somewhat more general than line of business, but if it makes it easier for you, think of it as a line of business. Now, for some purposes, these dependencies may be expressed as correlations. Not for all purposes. And I'll anticipate some future comments simply by stating that correlations are useful when one is working somewhere near the middle of the distribution and tend to be rather lacking in usefulness as one moves into the tales. Now, here's a simple little example of why we care about large correlation matrices. A large insurer could easily have 50 segments, and I've seen cases where there have been more. But I'd regard 50 as unremarkable for a large insurer. So let's take a simple case. There are 50 segments. There's no fine structure within the segments. By that I mean a segment is just the liabilities for a segment are just a number, and we're not concerned about how that number is made up for the moment. I'll come back to that question. But immediately, even with that very loose structure, we have a 50 by 50 correlation matrix, and that has more than 1,000 free entries in it. So populating that correlation matrix by hand is a very difficult and a very, very dubious business. But it does get worse, because ultimately, the way that you probably would like to look at this is that each segment has a claim triangle associated with it. Now, this isn't common practice, because this makes things very difficult. And part of our purpose here today is to produce a structure where that can be done, without blowing the magnitude of the problem out to proportions that are not feasible. So the dependencies that I was talking about between business segments may not be the same across all the triangles, and almost certainly would not be. So the problem is now much larger. For example, suppose we want to consider correlation specifically between diagonals within these triangles. So if we keep to a simple case with 50 segments, the triangles are only 10 by 10, and it's, that's usually they're at least that big. That means you have 45 cells in each lower triangle if you're trying to do a projection. And you now have, with 50 segments, you now have over 2,000 cells. And so you now have a 2,000 plus by 2,000 plus correlation matrix, which is 2.5 million odd entries requiring specification. So if one wants to pursue this avenue of looking at business segments and looking at triangles for each business segment and include reasonable dependencies, how should one go about it? And in going about it, one would usually want to observe certain requirements. But first, the correlation matrix you produce should be known to be positive definite. If it doesn't, you're at risk of producing some very weird results somewhere. The magnitude of each entry in the correlation matrix should be seen to be reasonable. And the relative magnitudes of pairs of entries should also be reasonable. And that last requirement blows the problem up very considerably, because there are actually 3 trillion pairs, about 3 trillion pairs of correlations in that 2,000 by 2,000 odd matrix. So it sounds as though I'm gradually working up to an insoluble problem here, but I hope to show you that it isn't. Okay, we'll discuss mainly correlations. We'll step out of that scope towards the end, but for nearly the whole talk, I'll be talking about correlations. And as I mentioned before, these are meaningful representations, usually meaningful representations of dependency, only for distributions that don't deviate too far from normal. And of course, a lot of our distributions do deviate from normal, and we need to take note of that. So they're suitable for measurement of dependencies between random variables that are not too distant from the mean, because, you know, even if you have a log normal distribution, it's got a very different tail from normal, but it looks pretty similar in the middle. So as long as we're dealing with moderate percentiles, we can usually use correlations. And I think for the type of application that I'm discussing here, risk margins, it would be unusual not to be able to use correlations effectively. I should mention, because I see some people noting things down, and that's fine, but we've agreed that this will go on the Institute website, so you'll have access to it later. So most of the presentation relates to risk margins rather than capital margins, which we see as being a different animal. But we will come back to capital margins at the end and try to say something useful about them as well. Okay, now common shock models. I'm going to show you a very simple model, you see that I label it possibly a trivial model, but it will serve as a prototype for what we need to work with here. So suppose you have three random variables, independent, X, Y, and Z, and now you construct two new variables, A and B, by taking linear combinations of, first of all, Z and X, and then of Z and Y, where the alphas and betas are constant. We'll assume they're greater than zero throughout this. For most purposes, they need not be, but it will avoid me having to single out special cases where things don't work quite properly if the alphas and betas are not strictly positive. Now, the first thing you can notice about this simple little system is that those new variables, A and B, are dependent, provided that Z's not a degenerate random variable, just sort of concentrated at a single point. Suppose, though, it has some kind of dispersion. Then A and B are dependent, and the covariance between them is a very simple expression. It's the product of the alphas and a sigma squared, where I haven't written it, but you can probably guess sigma squared Z is the variance of Z. And I've worked with covariance here. If you try to write down the correlation of A and B, it's not nearly as simple because it involves square roots and all that kind of stuff. So covariance is easier to work with through this talk until we come right to the end, and then I'll be able to reduce everything to correlations, which are much better when you're attempting to work intuitively. So this is a common shock model. You might wonder whether the model has enough substance that it even deserves a special name, but anyway, in 2003, someone gave it a special name, and it's the common shock model. And that's what we'll work with. That's all we need, really, to get from now to the end. Very, very simple structure. Okay, so now we want to apply this to claim triangles, supposing that we've got a number of claim triangles that may have dependencies between them. So I'll just spend a minute or two talking about the framework and the notation so that it's clear what we're talking about as we go. So we'll be considering a capital N business segment. So N is any natural number. Each is associated with an upper claim triangle. For forecasting purposes, you'll need a lower claim triangle, which makes everything slightly different. But we can translate. Everything I say can be easily translated from one to the other. The entries in the triangle are denoted X, and they're labelled by the business segment, the accident year, and the development year. So it's the X sub IJ that you're accustomed to seeing, and then with a superscript added to recognise the business segment under discussion. All triangles, we'll assume here, are congruent, that is, they're all the same size and shape. These conditions are not really necessary. They make it easier to talk about all this, and it just makes everything more difficult and more time-consuming to relax these conditions, but we could if we wished. We don't actually require triangles, and in the associated paper that we currently have in draft form, we require two-dimensional arrays. We're not specific about what the shape they are, and they can have holes in them as well if that's what's needed. We don't require congruence, but again, it's easier to talk about this if we do require it. It goes to a dictum that comes from Niels Bohr, the physicist from the 1920 or so, who once made the statement that accuracy and accuracy and clarity are mutually exclusive. And that's certainly the case here. We could be very accurate in what we want to talk about here and relax conditions and so on, but it would be harder to understand it, so we'll stick with the simple cases. So the framework looks like this. You've got a bunch of capital N triangles, and there may or may not be dependencies between these, and if there are dependencies, we need to spell out what they are. Okay, so let's think about constructing these dependent models. Now, dependency might occur within a single triangle, or it might be between a number of triangles, or it could be both. So we need to think about these different cases. So let's take within triangle dependency first, because that appears as though it would be the easier one. So we have a single triangle. It's triangle number N. It doesn't matter which one it is. We're just talking about triangle N for the moment. And we have cells. We take two general cells, I labelled IJ and KL, and we want to create dependency between them. Well, we just use our common shock model. So our observable, X, is defined to be a linear combination of two quantities, W and Z. And note that there is a difference between W and Z in that... I pressed the wrong button that time. Okay. In that, where is that pointer? Notice that W has no IJ subscript on it and Z does. So this means that the variable W, it's labelled by N, but that's just the triangle within which we're working. So W applies across the entire triangle. And Z is specific to a particular cell. We assume, as in the definition of the common shock model, we assume that W and all the Zs are independent. So the W with its constant multiplier is the common shock component, and The other component, which is cell-specific, is the jargon for this is it's the idiosyncratic component. This is lifted from the economics literature. We didn't invent it, but that's what it is. Okay, so here's here's our model, and we're continuing to assume that the constant multipliers in this model are strictly positive. And so we can now easily calculate the covariance. Now, you see it consists of two terms that relate to the two terms in the model. But notice that the second member in that expression includes a Kronecker delta term, which means that the delta is 1 if the couple ij equals the couple kl. In other words, we're looking at the same cell. Both cells are the same. And it's 0 otherwise. So if we're just looking for a variance where ij equals kl, we'll have two terms. But if we're looking for covariances, only the first term survives. And it's, again, just the form we saw in the model I displayed earlier. That's a product of two betas and a variance term. Okay, so that note this creates dependency between all cells in the triangle. This is, we'll look at alternatives to this in a moment because you might not want that to happen. But this first simplest model creates dependency between all cells in the triangle. And note that this covariance matrix must be strictly positive definite by construction. We've constructed genuine random variables, and so their covariance matrix must be positive definite. And that comment will apply to everything we do here. Wherever we construct covariance matrices, they will be positive definite for this same reason. So here's this is a stylized illustration of the covariance matrix that comes out of this. The axes are labelled by development year within accident year. So, let's see if I can get this to work. Ah, here we go. So here's accident year 1 across here, and then accident year 2 across here, and here are the development years within accident year 1, within accident year 2, and so on. And the darker the shading, the greater is the intended, the greater is the covariance that is illustrated. So these colours, they're not strict. You notice I use the word schematic form. These colours are not strict colour codings, but that diagram is intended to indicate that in broad terms, as you look at the diagonal will contain larger entries than the off-diagonal because the diagonal contains all the variances. And I illustrated a moment ago that variances contain two sum-ands in that formula and covariances contain only one. So I've coloured the matrix, that grey colour, to indicate that the entries are non-zero, they're strictly positive. If I'll use white in subsequent diagrams to indicate zero. So they're non-zero, but they're bigger in broad terms as you go down the diagonal. Right, now, that created dependency between all cells in the triangle, but you might want to create dependency between rows of a triangle as an example. So let's look at that. And the blue script here is just repeating results from earlier slides, so there's nothing new to see there. But now suppose that one wishes to introduce only row-wise dependency. That is, the covariance is non-zero if and only if I equals K, right? So the two entries in the covariance come from the same row if I equals K. Well, this is easy to do because we now just label the common shock variate W with a subscript I to indicate that there's a different one of these variates, different common shock for each row. Nothing else to do, just that simple change. And then the covariance formula you see at the head of the slide changes slightly in that changes in two ways, which I've marked in red. First, it gets a Kronecker delta in front of it that indicates that that contribution to the covariance reduces to zero if I is not equal to K, that is if you're in different rows, and the sigma squared W now becomes dependent on row I. We can have different variances for different rows. We don't have to, of course. You could make it the same if you wished. And now the covariance matrix looks like this. It's got a little more structure to it. The labelling is the same as before. There's development years within accident years. You still see the larger entries appearing on the diagonal. But now you see that if you look at the top... Oh, sorry. I keep doing that. If you look at the top left grey square, you'll see that it corresponds to accident year one on the vertical axis and accident year one on the horizontal axis. So, but once we move outside of that, then the colouring is white, indicating that there's no dependency here, but there is dependency within each row. And of course, you will have thought of this already. If we can have row-wise dependency, then we can have column-wise and diagonal-wise, but these are constructed in a parallel manner. So row-wise, we just saw. Column-wise, well, the common shock factor is dependent on the column J, and diagonal-wise, it's dependent on the diagonal T. So T is defined as I plus J minus 1, which is a diagonal. So we can construct all of those fairly simply. And, of course, they can all be present simultaneously. There's nothing to stop that. So you can then have this rather complicated-looking expression where the cell observation is defined as a common shock that's labelled A double R, which stands for array. So it's common across the array. Then the next term is common across a row, the next one a column, the next one diagonal, the next one idiosyncratic. So you can put all those in at once if that's what you want to do. Now, let's go back to the row dependency example that I just gave, and I showed how we could white out some areas of that covariance matrix. But as soon as you do that, questions start to form in your mind. Because this has dependency only within a row. Any row, but only within a row. And observations from the different rows are independent. And you might say to yourself, well, why would that be? Would it not make sense to have a more graded approach than that, where all rows are dependent, But the dependency decreases as the separation between the rows increases. So here's a way of doing that in a fairly simple manner. We do it using an AR1 time series. So here's the definition of an AR1 time series. The series is the series of values D, and each entry in the time series, dt, consists of some fraction of its predecessor, dt minus 1, and then plus some random disturbance, where the random disturbance has a zero mean and some variance. Now, the reason this is useful is that you can show that if you go far enough into this time series that it's forgotten its initial conditions, then the covariance between two members of the series is a constant multiplied by some power of that parameter theta, where the power is the difference between the instance of the two observations, t minus s. So we're looking at the covariance between the observation at time s and the observation at time t, difference between them, t minus s, and the covariance is a multiple of theta to the t minus s, and where theta was the thetas, you see it at the top of the slide there, it's the parameter describing how one member of the time series relates to the previous one. So this, in other words, you have a geometric decay as members of this time series become further apart, provided that theta's between 0 and 1. And that's a reasonable form of dependence between things like rows, diagonals, and so on. And it seems reasonable to me anyway, that you might think that you can have dependence between cells within a row, but if you now take dependence between cells that are within successive rows, then maybe that dependence is only 0.8, say, of the dependence within a single row. And if they're two rows apart, then 0.64 and so on. So it's a fairly simple but fairly effective form of dependence. Okay, so this is probably, I've been talking in terms of rows, but it's probably more commonly applicable to diagonals. It's probably diagonals where you'd want to look for specific forms of dependence. So let me go to diagonals, and there is the model of a common shock model for diagonal dependence that I gave earlier. So now remember that W is dependent on T. So now let's specify its dependence on T as one of these AR1 time series. And then with minimal mathematics, you can arrive at the result shown there, that the contribution of the common shock term to the a covariance between cells is some constant times the product of the betas and then multiplied by theta raised to the power you see there. And that power is just the distance between the two diagonals. So now, if you implement that, then my schematic takes that form. Where you see that Let's run across the top row of this matrix. The first entry in the top row is a variance term, and so it's been coloured black. The next is the covariance between the first... I think I've got it here. Yes, axes are now conveniently labelled by accident year within calendar year because it's the diagonals in which we're interested, so I've made calendar year the primary label. So the first row is calendar year one and how its covariances with other calendar years may be represented. So the first entry in row one is the covariance of that calendar year with itself. Then we have its covariance with terms in the second calendar year, and the second calendar year will have two entries, the third calendar year three, and so on. And as you run across that row, you see that we go from darker grey to lighter greys, indicating that as the separation between the diagonals increases, we get smaller covariances. So we have a much richer covariance structure here and probably approximating the sort of thing that you would like to use in practice. Okay, that's just within triangle dependencies. We haven't touched yet on between triangle dependencies, so let's look at that. But it's not hard. It sounds like it's going to be another whole chapter, but in fact, with the background that we've just built up, it's fairly easy. So let's, just for the sake of an example, let's talk about diagonal-wise dependency. But now we want to reflect dependencies between triangles. So here's where we got to with diagonal-wise dependency within a triangle. If we want to add diagonal-wise dependency between triangles, and I mean add, we're keeping the dependency within a triangle and we're adding further dependency between triangles, it's easy. We add another term. You notice that the term added looks like the one that was already there. The term involving the alpha looks like the term involving the beta, except that it's now not dependent on the triangle. So this term is specific to diagonal number T, but it applies to every triangle. So this creates dependence across the triangles. And if you want the covariance out of that model, there it is. Obviously, you're going to get an extra term in it, which is the brown term there. Notice that the way that covariance is constructed is that we just take the covariance at the top. Oop, what have I done? Here we go. We just take the covariance at the top, this one here, transfer it down here, because it's still applicable within a triangle, but we put a delta in front of it. So if m is not equal to n, that is, we're not staying within one triangle, then this term drops out. So now it's useful to recognise that we've constructed a covariance with three members, and it's useful to recognise what those three members mean, how to interpret them. The first one gives you covariance between triangles on a diagonal. The second one gives you covariance within a triangle, on a diagonal, and the last one is the cell variance within a triangle. And now we can draw up another of these schematics where the covariance matrix now needs to recognise a number of triangles. So the squares, the larger squares in this matrix are submatrices. For example, if I point to this one, this is the covariance submatrix relating to array 1 and array 2. And if you look within a single one of these submatrices, the structure looks more or less the same as the structure that was created for diagonal dependence in a single triangle, right? So, for example, the top left block of this covariance matrix is exactly the same as the case of a single triangle with diagonal dependence. But you notice that as you move to a different triangle, the dependencies between diagonals are different. And in this illustration, they're less, which is what you would usually expect. Okay, and you can add in the other types of dependencies if you want to. That's just an example to illustrate. Okay, now let's talk about trying to reduce all this to something a bit more simple. So up to now, I've probably frightened you because I just keep adding more and more terms in and saying you can add even more. But at the end of all this, we've got to put numbers on all this and try to use it. So let's look at that question. Now, it would be ideal if we could actually estimate all these things, but there is some literature on this, but not much. And what we're doing in this presentation is recognising what happens in practice, which is what is politely referred to as heuristic estimation, which translates into guesswork, hopefully informed. And I have nothing whatever to say against that. I mean, that there are lots of times in this type of work where you just don't have the data. Someone might tell you that, yes, it tells you in the literature how to do this or that, but it's not going to be done this quarter. Maybe a year from now someone will have it done, but right now we've got to produce some numbers. And so the thrust of this next section is how do we produce numbers which are halfway sensible? And here I refer to Niels Bohr again. Another one of his dicta is prediction's very difficult, especially if it's about the future. Okay, so we now want to concentrate on reducing the results we have to a form that has these properties. It's brief and it's palatable. Right? It consists of terms that are relatively few in number and very importantly, they're intuitive in their interpretation and without a major loss of accuracy along the way. And if we can do this, then I think the practitioner has a reasonable chance of reasonable accuracy using heuristic parameter estimation. So let's go back to the last example I did, which was between triangle diagonal dependency, and I've repeated here the covariance structure. And it looks formidable. But there's one simplification we can make very quickly here, which makes everything a lot easier. Notice that each of the three members of this expression consists of some constant multipliers and a variance term. Right? And now, to implement this, we, in its present form, we need to make estimates of those multipliers, for example, the alphas, and those variances, the sigmas. But the sigmas can actually be absorbed into the alphas. Right? So we can actually reduce the formula to this much simpler form where I've abused the notation slightly because I use alpha in both places, but the alphas at the bottom, the alphas in the bottom expression are the alphas in the top expression multiplied by their associated sigma. Right, so we just change the meaning of our parameters to reduce their number. So we're now working with this somewhat simpler expression. Now, we can actually produce something very useful if we look at a special case of this. So suppose that the triple MIJ equals the triple NKL. Now, that just means that the two variables within the covariance are the same. They're the same thing. So we're talking about variances now. And so all those ugly-looking deltas disappear. They all become one. And we get a very simple expression for the variance. And we noted the nature of these components earlier. It was between triangle, within triangle, and cell specific. So the cell variance decomposes into these three contributions: a diagonal common shock across all triangles, a diagonal common shock specific to a triangle, and idiosyncratic noise specific to a cell. If we want to include time series effects that I illustrated earlier, which were characterized by the parameter theta, then the theta parameters would need to be guesstimated separately. But they're all the parameters that are in this covariance: alpha, beta, phi, and possibly theta. So we just need to estimate them. Now, there's a little bit of mathematics in the paper following this, which we omit, but we go directly to the conclusion. The conclusion is that the entire dependency structure is defined by these parameters. For each cell in each triangle, we need to take the decomposition of the cell variance into its three components. For each triangle, we need the value of the AR1 coefficient if the time series effects are present. And across all triangles, the similar thing. If there's an AR1 time series across triangles, we need its parameter as well. So a total of 3n plus 1 parameters. In my initial simple example with 50 business segments, that's 151 parameters, still a lot. But of course, if you're trying to define a matrix with a couple of million terms in it, you should expect that there'll be some parameters in there. And these parameters are it's basically three for each line of each business segment you're looking at. Pick three parameters, so that's not a big task. You just have to do it 50 times. And then there's another one after that. So let me give you a numerical example of this. Now, to do a numerical example, we need to use small dimensions. Otherwise, I can't illustrate anything. But take my word for it that you can scale this up as necessary. So I'll choose n equals 2. So 2 business segments. I, the total number of rows, 4. J, the total number of columns, 4. It's 4 by 4 triangles. So it's 10 observations per triangle. 20 by 20 correlation matrix. So it's about as much as I can fit on a screen and still make it sensible. So for each cell and each triangle, we have to choose the decomposition of the cell variance into its 3 components. For this example, I'll assume that that decomposition is the same for all cells in the triangle. Now, that may be perfectly reasonable for the case you're looking at. It's not trivial. I don't think making this assumption produces an example which is automatically unrealistic. That's my assumption, that the decomposition of each cell's variance into its 3 parts is the same across the triangle. And for triangle 1, it's 0.1, 0.3, 0.6. So 0.1 of the variance in that triangle, of any cell in that triangle, comes from between diagonal dependency. 0.3 comes from within diagonal dependency, and the rest is the idiosyncratic part. And for triangle 2, 0.1, 0.1, 0.8. So you might equate this to triangle 1, you might think of as CTP, and triangle 1 motor. In CTP, you might equate it because you think that in CTP, the within diagonal dependence will be stronger than in motor. That's the 0.3 versus the 0.1. Right? You may not agree with me if you don't choose some other numbers. For each triangle, we have to choose the AR1 coefficient. And in the particular example I'm working on, it had AR1 coefficients for both within and between triangle dependencies. So triangle 1 and 2 assumed to be the same, 0.3 and 0.6. Sorry, I said that wrong. This is the coefficient controlling within triangle dependence across diagonals, and the parameter is 0.3 in triangle 1 and 0.6 in triangle 2. And then across all triangles, the time series effect for between triangle dependence, and that's assumed here to be 0.2. Okay, so just plug all those numbers into the formula and out comes the matrix. And there it is. So, it's lots of numbers. Doesn't mean a whole lot, but what it shows is that if you just read a few of those numbers, there's nothing there that looks silly. You see that as if you look within a triangle, which is the within triangle 1 is the top left submatrix, and within triangle 2 is the bottom right. If you look within them, you see that the covariances do reduce as you move, as the diagonals become achieve a greater separation. You see that as you move from within a triangle, such as the top left submatrix to correlations between two triangles, such as the top right, that the correlations are generally less, which is the sort of thing that you would want to see. And the within diagonal covariances are indicated there by shading. Right, now we're nearly to time, so let me just have a brief word about capital margins. I already noted that one would usually not want to rely on correlations in constructing capital margins, because we're concerned with the extreme tail, and that's where correlations perform extremely badly. Common practice, to the extent that there's a common practice in the industry in producing capital margins, and here we're talking mainly about internal models, the common practice is probably, well, it is in some cases and perhaps in all of them, to use a t-copula. So one estimates the marginal distributions of everything and then puts a t-copula over the top. Now, the t-copula is defined by its correlation matrix and degrees of freedom. And if you talk to the actuaries who do this stuff, then they'll freely admit that there are some difficulties in making these choices. So the purpose now is to make a small extension to the work that I've presented up to now, to inform the calculation of capital margins. Right, now we have to choose the degrees of freedom of a t-copula, and one way of approaching this, which I think is probably the most useful, is to think in terms of tail dependencies. It's the tails, after all, that we're looking here. We're concerned with dependency, so put the things together and the coefficient of tail dependency suggests itself. In case you're not familiar with it, I'll give its definition. This is a quantity that is specific to the extreme tails of distributions. It doesn't care at all what's happening around the middle of the distribution, only what's happening in the tails. And here's the definition. So the coefficient of, this is the coefficient of upper tail dependency here. There is a lower one, but that's not of any interest to us. Designated by lambda. Okay, now look at the definition. It's it involves a probability that X2 is greater than something, given that X1 is greater than something. Right, so it's a pairwise measure. It's measuring the tail dependency between two distributions. Now, what are the somethings here? Well, you've got this funny notation, the F arrow, where F denotes the distribution function. So F2 is the distribution function of X2. and I'll give you the definition of the F arrow, but probably the best way to think of it is that F arrow is just the inverse of F. And if we're dealing with an absolutely continuous random variable, then it's exactly the functional inverse of F. The only reason for putting the arrow there and having another definition is that we need something to deal with discrete distributions where the usual, where the functional inverse is not fully defined. Right? So it's called the generalized inverse, and there's its definition. But I don't want to dwell on that. Just let's talk as if we're dealing with a continuous distribution here, and F arrow is just F inverse. Then what the definition is saying is we take the probability that X2 is greater than F inverse of Q. That means probability that X2 exceeds the quantile Q of that distribution, given that X1 exceeds the same quantile of its distribution. Okay, so we're all interested in 99.5 percentiles. So you can think of this, an example of this, the probability that motor liabilities exceed their 99.5 percentile, given that CTP liabilities exceed their 99.5 percentile. And then finally, we don't work with a specific percentile, but we let the quantile Q increase to 1. Take the limit. Okay, so there's your definition of tail dependency. Well, I'm claiming here that a capital actuary would normally be able to take a view on this. If you can't do that, then you won't get any further down this road. But I think that's a reasonable claim. Okay, so then the process is as follows. We note that we've already got a correlation matrix, which we believe is appropriate to the centre of this T distribution. So let's keep that and make our T copula consistent with that. And let it choose the degrees of freedom so that the tail behaviour conforms with our guesstimated coefficients of tail dependency. So we make estimates of the tail dependency for all the pairs of segments. These are our guesstimates. We tabulate the T copula. The T copula now has only one parameter that is not determined. That's the degrees of freedom. So we tabulate the T copula for varying degrees of freedom and its tail dependencies for those varying degrees of freedom. And we select the degrees of freedom which give a rough match to our guesstimated tail dependencies. If we can do that, then we have a T copula which gives us tail behaviour which we believe to be correct, and correlation behaviour in its centre part which we've constructed and also believe to be correct. If we can't do that, you choose all these tail dependencies, and possibly when you look at the T copula with varying degrees of freedom, you just can't match them. Well, what that tells you is that T copula doesn't work with your guesstimates. There's nothing more you can do except throw away the T copula or change your guesstimates. Okay, just some final remarks then. We've constructed dependency models across triangles for multiple business segments. We have flexible models that allow for within and between triangle dependencies, row, column and diagonal wise dependencies, and more or less anything else. Another thing I haven't mentioned yet is that in the paper, instead of talking about just rows and columns and diagonals, we talk about subsets. So you can define the subsets to be anything you like. A subset might be a row, but it could be some weird shape if that was your interest. So the dependencies can be defined pretty much generally. You can include time series dependencies between different rows and columns and all the rest. We've expressed the models in a parameterization that has it's a number of parameters that I think is small. I mean, if I say it's 151 parameters, you might say that's a lot of parameters, but for the magnitude of the problem, I call it a small number of parameters. Those parameters are intuitive in their interpretation. They sort of, when you read them, you think of something that's kind of physical. And the models apply directly to to risk margins as well, or they may if the T copula matches your opinion of tail behaviour. So, so that brings us to the end, and we can take questions if there are any.
Are there any questions? Wait for the microphone.
Hi, thanks for the presentation. In your work, did you consider the concept of proximity between business segments, or did you just assume that they're all equally matched between each other? So, for example, the motor one you gave with motor and CTP compared to a business segment which isn't related at all.
I'm on? Yeah? Yep. Actually, it's a good point. We didn't consider that business segments might have some metric of separation of their own. So that's a good question. I guess when it comes to choosing those parameters, though, you could recognise that and ensure that where you consider two business segments to have some kind of similarity, that you choose the parameters for those business segments to be similar. But yeah, thanks for the point. It's a good one.
Anybody else?
I noticed in one of the, in, I think it was the last big array with the four squares that represented two different arrays and the various covariances between them. I noticed that in the top right square, yeah, thanks for that. I'll just wait. Yeah, that one. Yep. So I noticed in the top right square, there seems to be relatively little differentiation between the cells within that top right square. So, like, there's lots of point ones. Now, I thought that one of the tests of this kind of model is basically looking at various pairings and checking if we think that it matches our intuition. And I wondered how much thought you've given to whether, for example, that top right square, so whether the lack of differentiation matches our intuition on how the covariances should work.
Well, it's all in the model that you construct. Now, this was a model that was diagonal-wise dependent. So that means that if you have observations on the same diagonal, they'll have the same covariance. Unless you're looking at an actual variance, and that's what you see here. The squares coloured grey are within diagonals. So you've got a 1x1 up the top. That's the first diagonal. You've got a 2x2. That's the second diagonal. 3x3 is the third diagonal. And everything within a diagonal has the same covariance. All pairs within a diagonal have the same covariance. And you'll see the same thing on the left, except that on the left-hand side, down the diagonal, you get variances, and so that makes them different. But otherwise, if you look at the top left big square and look at the bottom right small square within it, you'll see they're all point fours except where they're one. So the same thing happens there, and it's precisely because you have diagonal-wise dependence. I just gave this as a simple example. If I'd included row dependence as well, then you'd get the kind of differentiation you're looking for.
Okay.
But Just to clarify, what was the issue you had? What, the fact that they're all 0.10 or all 0.4?
It was just that there's somewhat little differentiation within that top right square, but it's exactly because of what Greg said.
Yeah, I mean, you can always include more differentiation within that, another AR1 within those diagonals. Now, the 0.4 and 0.1, I think, are related to the assumptions of how much of the variance comes from different components. Any other question? Still welcome comments offline afterwards. So.
Yeah. Okay. So thanks for all coming along and listening so patiently and attentively. I hope there's some benefit coming out of this. But anyway, that's over to you now. So thanks again.
Thank you.